don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate. Yeah. And nobody gives in that kind of world anything for you for free unless you have a trust and a long-term reputation and good things and track record.
The Operations Leadership Podcast with Gautam Basu provides insights for today's business leaders on creating value through operations improvement, process excellence, digital innovation, and organizational leadership.
In this episode of the Operations Leadership Podcast, we have guest Sami Miettinen. Sami is an author, investment banker, and popular podcast host, as well as a subject matter expert in the art and science of negotiation. And during this discussion, we talk about the importance, even superpower, of the skill of negotiation and why it's particularly relevant in these accelerated times of change and uncertainty. Hope you enjoy the podcast interview. Hi, Sami. How are you doing?
Great. Good day here in my alma mater at Aalto University.
Welcome. Welcome back.
I'm from business school.
Excellent. Excellent. Sounds good. So, Sami, you have a popular podcast in Finland, and you know, I've been a guest on that as well. So now it's your turn for being a guest on the Operations Leadership Podcast.
Excellent, and that was a very popular episode, and we had Gene McNaughton as the sort of a guest speaker alongside with you, and discussed the American negotiation style and also sales.
Absolutely. So, I mean, for those of our listeners that are not familiar with your work, just tell us a little bit about your background and experience, you know, in broad terms.
Yeah, I call myself an evil investment banker just for the laughs, because of course I bankers don't have the best reputation out there, so you have to kind of lighten it up. And but indeed, I'm an investment banker. I used to live 13 years in London, spent 1 year in the States as well in New Orleans, and was working in the big investment banks, Credit Suisse, RBS, SEB. But then in Finland, I've been working in more boutique investment banks, and now I'm a partner in Translink Corporate Finance. It's a global mid-market player, and we do typically 20 to 50 million euro M&A and IPO deals.
Nice.
That's my professional background. I am an author of the market leader in negotiation literature in Finland, Uusi Neuvotteluvalta, and it has sold something like 30,000 copies. So it has flooded the market. Then again, there isn't that much any other negotiation book, so it's a bit misleading.
Yeah.
But that's, I think it's a bit of a, it is an academic work. So I try to source my theories on the book. And I think it's a solid piece of work on how to negotiate effectively.
Good stuff. Yeah. And so, you know, speaking of the book, you did write this book. And maybe what was your rationale in writing this book? And did you feel that there was for example, a knowledge gap in the negotiation literature?
Definitely. I think you can look at as a play on liquidity. I mean, the academic people here in Aalto, especially in economics, they have a often very macroeconomic view on the world. So they assume things like liquidity in money market or banking or capital markets, that the capital just happens. So if you have a good business idea or project, then magic happens and the capital will find that. And that's, of course, very, very naive. Then on the other end, we have people who walk to the commercial store and buy a loaf of bread or milk. And of course, you don't negotiate. You take the price or leave the shop. But in the middle, there's a very, very interesting area of limited liquidity. So people, where you do deals, for example, M&A or IPOs or funding for your startup or even selling your house or complex supply chain negotiations, I guess your area of expertise. And that's definitely something you don't learn. You're not learning in your basic studies. You're hardly learning in the academic studies. And
well, they do have negotiation classes.
Yeah, but it's...
I've seen them and I've taken a few.
Yeah, and some of them are very good. But then in the business, a lot of people learn to negotiate from their boss. And your boss could be a terrible negotiator. And you could have a terrible culture of negotiating in your company.
Yeah.
And since it's one of the biggest value added items you can do in your life. It's a miracle people don't take it seriously.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like influencing people are terrible generally in influencing the other people, persuasion. In marketing, persuasion.
Yeah. Yeah.
So definitely to ask your question, there's a huge gap in skills.
Well, skill gap, I would tend to agree with you. But if you're as putting your author hat on, I'm sure you looked at the literature in, for example, folks, academics, non-academics that wrote, because it is such an important skill, to agree with you. So what was your process in writing a book? Did you have to cover, like similar to what we do in a literature review, did you look through the literature and find out that there were some gaps and he wanted to fill the gap?
Definitely. I mean, there's a lot of, I have four levels in my book, so there's a lot of silos on the research and practice on negotiations. The two first levels, I argue, are overanalyzed. You have power balance, and then you have the analytical balance, theory. So there's a lot of academic work on that. There's a lot of good books on that. But then the third and fourth layers on my book, the social skills and the principles.
Right.
You have a completely different set of literature. It tends to be even stuff like influence and self-help and even some kind of even religions that they deal with principles, ethics.
Yeah.
But at the time of the writing of the book, nobody integrated those four levels, even internationally. So I take some pride in combining the disciplines of from the soft influencing skills, principles, ethics, to the hard negotiation literature of power and analytics and game theory.
And I like the term that you use. I heard you said it many times, is that you don't get what you deserve, but what you negotiate.
Absolutely. And it sounds harsh, and it is, but it's we live in a transactional world. I mean, we lived in that even before Donald Trump, but we definitely live in the transactional world now. And those people who have the view of fairness, so you owe everybody, almost like a communist idea that you should get according to your needs and you should contribute according to your skills. But the world doesn't work like that. And if it were to work like that, it would be a hellish place, because people would just exploit each other, because everybody would have a lot of needs and nobody would have much to contribute. So you need to match. You don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate.
Yeah.
And nobody gives in that kind of world anything for you for free, unless you have a trust and a long-term reputation and good things and track record.
Yeah.
Then you might get things for free because you are trusted and a value-adding partner in your own right. But it's a core principle, and it's a good thing. If everybody would just get the automatically some sort of base level, then you couldn't strive forward, because you just would hit the perfect market all the time, and all the prices would be fairly priced. All the deals would be just one price. You could get a little bit of extra by doing research and structuring the negotiations right. So it's actually a positive view as well. So you don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate. You can add value by being active and structuring well and negotiating well.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you mentioned a bit about your framework, and you have the power, the analytics, and you had something around interaction and principles. So could you unpack each one of those to tell our listeners a little bit about this framework?
Well, the power balance is, we can use Donald Trump as an example. He says that people have been giving U.S. hard time and giving unfair deals. They have been putting high tariffs, high VATs, and the USA has been supplying them with free defense on the in the army level, and then also the world's biggest market. So you could argue that the USA has a very high power position, but it has been underutilizing it, so it hasn't demanded its worth. And of course, we Europeans, we tend not to agree with that view, because that comes as a surprise, because we have get used to in the situation where we have a low power, but we still get quite a lot from the USA.
But is it so that the EU does have low power? Because, I mean, or is it a function of the institutions changing 70, 80 years? The US was used to working in one way, which is more values-based, but now, moving towards more transactional.
Yes, at least the USA wasn't forcing its huge potential power before this. And you could say they were taking the long-term view and building a better value and win-win for everybody. Mm-hmm. But you can take it at the lower level. You could have a, let's say, a landlord and the guy who rents. Mm-hmm. And then you have a, you could say there's a power imbalance one way or other, but it's very much dependent on the sort of the supply and demand. If there are a lot of apartments for rent, then of course the guy who wants to rent, he has a high power, and then the each individual landlord has a low power. But then if you have the only limited supply, maybe because it's regulated market or maybe it's tight market, then the guy who wants to rent needs to take whatever is available and maybe even pay a high price for it. So it's situational. So it's but you need to first analyze that. Do you have more power than the other party? And if so, can you generate more power for yourself by adding liquidity? For example, if I want to rent a cheap apartment, if I only look at the certain area, then that limits my access to supply. So what if I look in the broader place that already increased the liquidity and my negotiation position? Maybe I open a lot of negotiation positions with a lot of potential landlords, and then that's the kind of a power play on it.
Sure.
And then you can use indirect power. We have a Dr. Cialdini who very famously studied in his book Influence, the levers of influence. You can access indirect power in reciprocity, status, liking, and those kind of things, to make the landlord like you or for some reason to give you a good deal.
Right.
So that's the power level.
So how would, could you give an example for our listeners that are from maybe more familiar with supply management? So how to deal with suppliers in, for example, sourcing, strategic sourcing kind of contracts that are, you know, and maybe you're a smaller company, you know, negotiating with a bigger company. Mm. Let's say if you're negotiating with Walmart, they have huge... Yeah. Power in the negotiation. So, what would be your advice?
Yeah, there? Definitely. I'm also a board member in a Fredman Group, which is owned by a private equity company called Corona Invest. So, I have a can give a little bit of insight on real world negotiations there. We have a both own manufacturing and we have a wholesale and we sell direct as well. So we deal with all of those places. We don't have a Walmart here, but we have a K-Kauppa and S-Kauppa and Lidl and the guys like that. So yeah. Very concentrated
big retailers.
Big retailers who have a different wholesale structures. Yes. But on the supply side, looking from the manufacturing point of view, there's a lot of inputs coming from our products, packaging and all kinds of special fast-moving consumer goods. So, for example, when there was a high inflation environment in after the corona, we got this inflation shock. It translated to double-digit inflation, a lot of key ingredients like aluminum and
raw materials.
So we created an index and we started tracking very carefully each individual input. Then we looked at our prime supplier and then looked at alternatives. So, and then made it clear to some of those guys that we are looking for alternatives. They get too greedy on the price.
Sure.
And then we indexed that. Then we argued for... our customers that, of course, there's a lot of cost inflation, so we need to put that through.
And In the form of pricing,
and have we had to defend our margin. And but then on the way down, when the inflation was down, we did the reverse. So we tried to push the indices down on the raw materials very fast because it's two-way street, but then defend the margin because then maybe our customers were not so wise on the indexing on the indexing the raw material. So classic kind of a thing. So, but that's a power play, but it already moves on the second level, which is analytics.
Yeah.
So once you figure out what the power balance, what you can do to improve it with the analytics, you do indices tracking, you increase the liquidity at the frameworks with the key supplier, you add the alternative supply, maybe you even switch supply to just to show you have a power.
Yes.
Like it's not forever.
also mitigating your supply risk, right? Mm. I mean, if you're single sourcing versus dual or tertiary sourcing, you have more options.
Definitely, and then sometimes it's mixed. You do both buy raw material, but you also do converting for them. So then it's a complex situation. So you have a, you might buy the raw material, you convert it, and you sell it back. Mm. So that's already a quite a complex situation. Yeah. So way, sure. So then it does kind of a U-turn on your system. So you okay. need to, it's already a next level complex on that.
So you have the power, which yeah. you described, in a
direct
negotiation.
Direct and indirect power. And
yes.
Liquidity.
Yes.
And the pricing, base pricing.
And then you have the analytics layer where you talk about the yeah. indices.
And the analytics has also two levers. If the power has direct power and indirect power, and the analytics, we have the just the kind of the engineering level of analytics where you look at the pricing and so on. And then you have a creativity. And the creativity is looking for the out-of-the-box solutions. And of course, with AI, that's huge because you can run all kinds of very innovative concepts and sort of play around with that what-if scenarios. And and so the analytics is no more kind of a linear programming or finding the local optimums or just doing your kind of a margin squeeze, but you can really go quite creative. What if we completely change the raw material mix? What if we do the printing ourselves or outsource the printing or whatever,
and
have a completely new category?
Yeah.
What if we do like a premium branding together with our customers using not their private label but the shared private label? Mm-hmm. And all kind of innovative things.
So that's the power in analytics. Then you have the interaction.
Interaction, so social skills, and then that's where you implement the deal. So you need to, often it's still human to human. So you need to manage your information flow. So you give your bid or ask or a negotiation position. But it's usually humans who do that. So you need to control your internal emotions. You need to manage the emotions, the other person's, and then you need to manage the information flow between you. And there that there's a lot of tricks or methods you can use. For example, you can look at the time pressure. So the one key principle is that on whose side the time is ticking, the clock is ticking. So if I hear a lot of ticking from my side, then I need to do deal. You can take the easy. You have more power. So, but if you have to do that really quickly, and I realize that's the position. Then I can play you, because right. then you are playing my game, and that's very important to understand what are the time dynamics.
The time dynamic that reminds me of this kind of constraint-led approach that's quite popular now. We're using either time or space to manipulate the game. But when you talk about, for example, this interaction, and if you're let's say in our world in supply chain in sourcing and purchasing, the end, you're trying to get to a contract, an agreement, and there are, you mentioned information asymmetry problems,
yeah.
but then you also have the let's say other problems like moral hazard or adverse selection.
Sure.
So how would you handle that? How does your framework kind of address these?
Yeah, then you have like references, of course, and then you eliminate a lot of the bad ex by just calling their current customers or suppliers. And,
references.
And then there's the public and non-public information. So you can use the public signaling. For example, you can announce we are moving to a new product category and we're looking for customers and suppliers. So that's a kind of on the open channel. But then how you deal on that on the private channel, that can be completely different streams of negotiation. Or you can decide, you don't say it publicly, but you just go to your trusted customers and suppliers and say, well, I'm doing this just for you and on the exclusive basis, and then that's, but if we don't get the deal, I have to go public. So you can play all kinds of levels on this. And then the information flow, there's a kind of a signaling theory. So basically, for example, the price anchoring, that's classics.
Yeah,
and
that's
So you have guys like Chris Voss is very popular.
Yeah. FBI
negotiator. Yeah, yeah. But he has this stupid theory that you should wait for the other guy to make the anchoring. And that's just, that makes no sense. He's a clever guy, but that's... Uh-huh. I think he's trolling with that advice. I mean, always anchor first.
And those that are not so familiar with negotiation, anchor is basically giving your offer first.
Yeah. And it can be quite hilarious with the professional negotiations because you have like a, everybody wants to go through the social interactions and small talk, but then it's the race to sort of hammer the anchor.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be really, really hilarious when you can kind of sense that this guy's just eager to throw in the his crazy,
so what is
his
the
crappy number.
So what is the correct way to anchor a negotiation?
That's there's some theory here actually developed by Aalto University, Matti Keloharjo on the public bits. And he found out, and he interviewed me, by the way, on this one also because I'm an M&A banker on doing deals. And he asked a lot of people the questions, and should you anchor on a round number or non-rounded number? And the correct answer is actually not rounded number. But the amateur offer is that, let's say you have a asset which is worth around 100,000 euros. So amateur would say, I'm offering 100,000 or I'm buying for 100,000, but the pro says it's 97,538 based on this reference number, which I'm deriving from this and this data.
Yeah.
So so the be specific, anchor first, and use reference data from a third party source, which is credible. So that's the key three keys of anchoring.
Nice. Okay. That's
and we go first. That's the most important.
So that's something our listeners can take away when they're negotiating some sort of agreement.
Yeah. For example, if you're selling your house, you can say, "Well, the average price on my territory, the area of housing, is 8,437 euros last quarter. But because of the upgrades I have done on my 100." Square meter apartment. I think this apartment is worth 100 euros more. So I'm willing to do a deal at 847,000 euros or something like that.
Right.
So basically, and instead of saying, well, I'm asking for 800,000.
Right.
Or waiting for the other guy to come up with the 670,000.
Yes. Sounds more precise, like you've done your homework.
Then of course you need to have a liquidity from the other party, and then you need to realize if he has other games going on, and then whether the clock is ticking on your side or their side. By the way, if the clock is ticking on your side and you're in deep shit, then excuse my French here, then you shouldn't be a naive guy who just anchors crazy prices. You just want to hammer the deal because otherwise you might go bankrupt or something.
Then it's counterproductive.
There are specific situations where you actually need to realize you don't have the power, you don't have the time, you don't have the liquidity. Then you need to have a Mr. Wolf and who will deal with the dirty situation, if you recall the scene from the Pulp Fiction.
Right. is that leaning more towards the principles?
It is, and it's analytics as well. I mean, because you need to make the correct situational assessment, what kind of deal I'm doing and what are my cards here.
Yeah.
And then on information theory, one further thing is that you have a, if you play the Texas Hold'em, so you have the visible cards and then you have the hidden cards. And that's a good analogy for sharing information. So you always want to share some information openly.
Yeah.
For example, if you're willing to do the deal, you shouldn't hide that because you want the transaction. You want the other party to understand you want the transaction. So usually it's not a good idea to play hard to get. So you don't want to waste people's times. And you don't usually lose much by signaling that you are liquid, you're open for business. You might want to share the anchoring openly and first with those principles I just told you. But then there are certain things. If you have a high time pressure, you are in going bankrupt, your bank is you're violating your covenants, then it's maybe not a good idea to tell them upfront. so as a sort of a, you keep them as a hidden cards.
Yeah.
And then the game on the other side, you try to see if the other guy has that kind of a hidden cards. And if you can unlock the hidden cards of the other side, that gives you, of course, a huge advantage.
Sure. That's the adverse selection.
Yeah.
Right?
And yeah. And there are tricks for that. Yeah. I mean, it's one trick is just ask directly.
Mm.
Are you violating your covenants?
Yeah.
Then you have to either lie or tell the truth.
right.
truth. And if you're not experienced negotiator, you're not completely befuzzled.
Well,
if you're an experienced negotiator,
that case you is can interesting. Expect that. That case is interesting because you're soliciting information.
Yeah.
And but then the other party could say false information.
Yeah, but if you lie, that's against principles. I tend to not
right.
lie.
Right, right. That's so, the principles aspect. So what are some other, let's say,
so for example, ask me that question. So let's say my hidden card is that I'm violating my covenants.
Mm.
So go ahead. Ask.
So have you had any problems with the bank, your bank loan, your debt in the past?
We have a good relation with our banks, but unfortunately our contracts are under NDA.
Okay.
Yeah. You have to be able to respond, because the person who is a novice negotiator, he knows he's get caught, but then he panics.
Yeah.
And you can read it from the, like, oh, body this language. Guy is yeah. definitely breaking his covenants.
Right.
Or then you lie, which can be very damaging, because if it's sure. uncovered, then you basically you're hurting the relationship.
Yeah.
So I don't lie, but I'm always prepared to not give the information indirectly on so those situations.
It's a little bit like jujitsu, negotiation jujitsu.
Yeah, but if you can, and the Finns are, by the way, terrible in direct questions. They tell, if you ask direct questions and you silence, then people will give you the information, which can be the hidden card.
Right.
And that's a little bit sad.
Well, Finns are known to be very good negotiators, right? There's a history of negotiation in Finland.
Yeah.
I mean,
I mean, this silence is very Finnish thing. We do it kind mm-hmm. of naturally. So you Americans are definitely not as comfortable as we are with the long silences. But I can take a 5 minute Finnish silence if I need to. That's, by the way, also that takes skill.
Yeah. It is definitely a skill.
Yeah. So if you need to take a 5 minute silence, yeah, you do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let the other guy talk.
Exactly.
Give me some hidden cards here.
More information. That's right. You also mentioned that negotiating partnering decisions utilize power to agree on complex transactions.
Mm.
For example, focus on your needs versus focus on other negotiating partners' needs. Mm. So what is the optimum there in that?
Yeah, I think then we touch on the fourth and final skill, which is the principles. So you need to have some kind of principle is kind of a value which has kind of a procedure attached to it. So it's basically how you deal with a certain situation. So, for example, a principle would be that I won't lie. But then you need to have a process. How you don't lying, and like I demonstrated you in the covenant situation.
Yeah.
So, and then in the partnering situations, it's like, are you aiming for a long-term relationship? Are you building a kind of win-win long-term relationship? Are you going for references and building a growing together? Or are you more transactional, like taking the best deal here and there as you go along and don't care too much about the sort of repeat business or recurring revenue? I think the rise of the SaaS businesses, that's, by the way, the biggest transaction type of transaction corporate finance, selling software as a service. That's highlights a very big importance of recurring revenues. And that's basically a trust business. So you add so much value that people are willing to give you a contract which is recurring and it's not terminated by a method called churn. So it's
that's the best form of revenue, right?
It is, and it's it can be high gross margin and it can grow and add. So once you win the business with the low churn, that's forever. So it's super valuable. So basically you're building a portfolio of recurring trusted partnerships with so much value also on the other side that they see no reason to quit you. And by the way, I'm running a SaaS workshop. So I had a workshop a couple of weeks ago where I had 25 SaaS CEOs, and I started with kind of disrupting that premise. I said, well, in this world with AI, there are a lot of people who are using AI to try to disrupt your continuing SaaS business to back to a transactional model. So why are you paying these guys 100 euros per month per user if you can buy our transactional services where you just buy the five transactions you need for 10 euros
different
each.
Business model.
Yeah, and that's happening. So I never take that for granted. And, the good negotiator is also willing to disrupt lucrative businesses because if you don't disrupt yourself, somebody else will.
Interesting.
And that's, by the way, I mean, long-term recurring revenue, short-term transactions, both are value-added type of things.
Right.
I mean, of course, if you're selling, you prefer the first one. But if you're buying, you might like the second one.
Of course.
Just buy on your needs.
Yeah. And maybe another question. You also talk about this dialogue planning. Mm-hmm. So what is the role of dialogue planning in the negotiation process?
Yeah, I mean, one way to look at the negotiations when you are approaching the signing of the contract or agreement. So the negotiation is a process where you end up agreeing and signing a contract. So, but then this planning process takes a view, for example, your classic sales funnel. So you have a marketing qualified leads, sales, and then you have a negotiations. So you need to, if you take that framework, then it's a time-based funnel, and you need to analyze where I am now. Am I cold calling marketing qualifying phase? If I'm there, how I move to the sales channel, and then from sales interaction, I go to negotiation in a proper way, which always adds to the probability of closing the high quality deal. So so then you kind of look forward 6 weeks from now, I want to be signing a contract with this company. I'm now talking with the first guy ever in that. How do I use my 6 weeks to end up in the signed contract with a good gross margin for me? And then you plan it. You call the first guy and then say, well, we have this offering and these are our references and are you the decision maker? If you're not the decision maker, could you introduce me to the decision maker? Then you structure the sales pitch. Then you convert the sales pitch to negotiation process, and then you close. Always be closing, and then it's just planning. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail.
Right. Yeah, you tend to emphasize that in some of your role plays and simulations to make sure that especially if it's a pair type negotiation where there's teams negotiating teams, you know, having that dialogue planning, it's quite
and then don't waste people's time. So a lot of people who are bad salespeople or bad negotiations, they think talking is the process, so they waste time and their money, and other people might get the free consulting lessons forever, but you don't even do the basic check. Is this guy the guy who has the authority to purchase my product?
Right, the decision maker.
Yeah, if not, how do I get that to be? And they just sort of stuck with that first level of bullshit talk.
Yeah. All right. And maybe moving on to some current events. I know this will probably come out, you know, a little bit later, but I think it's not secret information of what's going on in the world. And of course, with the current geopolitical events and even the uses of tariffs by the U.S., how do you see this as a negotiation strategy? Is it effective? You know, how do you see this from a broad perspective?
Well, definitely, if you introduce tariffs or some other measures of blocking free trade, they will have the impact of changing the trade flows. So in that way, it's of course effective. So if you don't have a tariff and then you suddenly have a tariff, then that will change the supply chains quite fundamentally by at least the level of the tariff, unless you can pass that through to the value chain. But then...
But this is an interesting point that you mentioned, is that... with a lot of these, let's say, trade and tariff, using tariffs as a mechanism, it will change the structure of the supply chains, whether it's nearshoring, bringing manufacturing back to the closer to the consumption point. That will change the fundamental structure of these supply chains, isn't it?
Yes.
And so how do you see, for example, in the EU, where Finland is a part of, how do you see Finland's, let's say, role changing, if at all, with this?
Yeah, I mean, it's usually when you have a trade wars and coming, it's not a good idea to be a small country because our economy is relying on the free trade and kind of
export.
Yeah, export, and then, but then we at the EU, which is a collective bargaining at the system. So, for example, it's hard for even for USA to have a country by country specific tariffs within EU. Whilst they could slam whatever they want in Vietnam or UK or China, even. So the one way is that. Definitely people are looking more on nearshoring within their sort of tariff area. So I would see quite near a natural trend in USA to focus on nearshoring the value chains within the USA, not so much even with the NAFTA countries, Mexico and Canada.
Yeah, and this was the surprising part because, I mean, you did have, you know, there's near shoring. There's also the concept of friendly shoring, right? So you have, for example, maybe manufacturing in Estonia.
Yeah.
Right. But here, it's you know what's happening in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico is that it's near shoring. They're definitely picking that and using tariffs as a mechanism. And I know a lot of supply chain folks and economists don't like the you know the tariffs as a mechanism for statecraft.
Yeah, I mean, USA doesn't have a federal VAT, so they are in the unique position compared to most other countries that they can introduce a new tax layer there. And for example, EU has on average 8% of GDP VAT layer, and USA has only a couple of percentages there because the federal layer has no VAT. There's only a little bit of sales tax in the States. So they have more room for this kind of a tax structure friction there than we do, because if you do a counter tariffs, then those pile up on top of the already high VAT tax levels. So USA has a sort of power, if we use the negotiation analogy here, they have a power advantage here. And they, of course, they're bigger and more self-sufficient market. Of course, they can't insource all of their raw materials and supply parts, and it's stupid to even try to do that. But then within EU, I think the nearshoring still works. Finns and Estonians can still do business because it's one customs area. Then it's a bit more volatile, let's say, between Norway and Finland or Switzerland and Great Britain, because they don't have the same sort of EU the tariff protection. So it could be that this becomes quite political. So the EU could decide, well, let's do a deal with Mercosur in South America and have a low tariffs there. Let's do a deal with Canada or even China, which would be a very interesting twist. And or we could just do our own walls and sort of increase the tariffs within the EU borders. And but EU is actually surprisingly a small part of the economy. It has EU has a budget of Sweden, so it's not it's a huge regulatory power, but it doesn't have much money. And interestingly, EU, I can see they try to generate own funds from these tariffs, because that's actually one thing people don't realize. The EU gets the first cut of the tariffs, so they can increase their own taxation level with this if they play this right, from the bureaucratic point of view.
Okay, all right. I didn't realize that, but now
yeah, but definitely this will be. I mean, Trump is definitely wants to make this a long-term negotiation issue. So we have only seen the first episode of this.
Right. So this is a. Would you say it's an effective negotiation strategy? What?
Well, it's definitely changing the trade flows. So in that way, it's effective. But I mean, I like the free trade model. So I'm a little bit sad. But yes. It's foolish to be idealistic. So if your business model went down the toilet, then you need to negotiate with the current reality. So and
it's make quite
the,
harsh.
Yeah, make the best out of it. So, yeah. But yeah, but that's the key thing in negotiation. You don't be idealistic. Just acknowledge the facts and the dice has been thrown and play with the dice that's been thrown.
I think this will be a hard thing for many people to adapt to because I mean, for so long, it was based on this kind of ideal of global trade, and I'm a product of globalism, and you know, it's. There's a lot of positives for it, a lot of positives.
Definitely. I mean, for Finland, especially with a lot of exports and small open economy, it's this transactional, more closed world is probably not a good outcome. But then again, I mean, we can play on our feet and adapt to it. So
yeah. And what is your idea, Sammy, about? For example, Finland as a kind of a small nation being able to, let's say, export and commercialize their very high quality products and services, you know, even though globalization, global trade may be going the other way.
Yeah.
You know, maybe within the EU or some of these other alternative countries.
I mean, we have a small home market, so that's not the huge benefit, but then we have a very robust energy infrastructure. We have a very capable defense and civil economy structure. A lot of dual use technologies, a lot of R&D, a lot of software skills and educated people. We lack capital on the private level, so that's a bit of a weakness. So we need to definitely boost that somehow.
Do you think there could be regional agreements, let's say, for example, in the Nordics or Nordic-Baltic?
There could be. I mean, I don't believe EU breaking up, although some people could see it going that way. But definitely you have these coalitions of the willing, if you use the sort of defense term. So you could have a coalitions of the willing on the trade and capital market joint business initiatives. So, yeah. And definitely there's more need to sort of get serious. So you can't be idealistic. You can't just have open tenders for everybody if this new world is transactional, that you're not the whole world is your friend. You need to pick your friends more carefully. So you can also qualify your friends a bit more carefully.
Yeah. And I think it's... You brought up some very interesting points, and you know the jury's still out to see, you know, if these things will be effective and what the impacts and what the world will look like in the next months, years, decades time. But any final words for our listeners that are more operations leaders, what would be your expert advice in terms of handling these maybe uncertain times, and also from a negotiation perspective, what would be kind of your...
Yeah, well, my co-author in this negotiation book, Johanna Torkki, just came out with a translation of the Stoic work from the Roman time masters, Seneca and... Marcus Aurelius, yes, and the third guy who starts with E, but I had a discussion with him on the same topics, and I said I like this, when the tough times are coming, the tough get going, and I'm actually excited. So because for once you can use your competence, you can add value, you can do good deals, you cut the excuse my friends bullshit, don't go on this soft world is a better place if you just do the minimum or whatever. So I'm actually full of optimism. I mean, now there are so many things moving that one who does the power analytics, social interactions principles thing right, they will have a huge advantage on the negotiations because the liquidity positions are all over the place, not only in the supply chains, but they're everywhere. Everybody's kind of a little bit clueless, like how the dice has been thrown and what are the new deals? And those who do the analytics first and go for it, they can do some great deals. So yeah. I'm I'm optimistic. So now it's the fourth turning. People will come strong. Hard times will bring back the strong men and women, and who will do the value-added deals.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Sammy. This has been very interesting. And for those of you, those of the listeners that want to get in touch with you, how can they kind of reach you?
Yeah. So I have a huge social media presence. So if you just Google Sami Miettinen, or then if you email me at sami.miettinen@dcmcapital.fi, I'm happy to talk with you.
Awesome. Thanks again, Sammy.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
That's it for this episode of the Operations Leadership Podcast. I'm your host, Gautam Basu. If you like what you're listening to with this podcast series, then please hit subscribe. And until next time.